Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I'm your host, Jeff Howard, and I am talking to Mike Harris. Hey, Mike.
Hey, what's up, Jeff?
I'm good. What's up is I'm talking to you about your favorite films. This is a four questions episode. If you are interested in Mike's work, and you should be, I'm going to not start over, but I just want to share that Mike, I know Mike because his film, I Am the Devil, was at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in 2020. I love that film. It's an excellent film about a true story of the CIA essentially kidnapping people, giving them LSD, and fucking with their minds. Fair enough encapsulation?
Yeah. That more or less gets it across.
And that is something that you should want to see. So you should watch Mike's film, I Am the Devil. It's going to be in Discover Indie Film, the TV series that is on Amazon Prime Video. It's in season 7 that is released on January 15th. So see his film, love it, enjoy it as much as I do. This podcast episode is not about Mike and his own work. It is about his answers to the Discover Indie Film 4 questions, which are favorite films of all time, an underrated film, an overrated film, and a lesser-known film that people should seek out. If you want to learn all about Mike, listen to the podcast before this one. I didn't write down the number. I almost have your number ready, but all right, I think we've said what we need to say for introduction. Mike is champing at the bit to answer these.
That's right.
I'm just going to let you go. What are your favorite films?
So we're doing top three, yeah.
Top three? If it's a tie for numbers, I always joke that
no,
I don't have
that.
A whistle.
Fuck
I'm not going to blow the whistle if you name a fourth.
I'm going to do three. It's really, I will say though, it's really, really hard to narrow it down to all time. What I'm going to do is I'm going to give you the top three that I think kind of form a constellation around I Am the Devil and kind of inform that film in a poetic kind of way, almost an ethical, ideological way. The first one, I'm going to do 1949, The Third Man by Carol Reed. I think that this is a wonderful, wonderful picture. It's shot in post-war Vienna, and it really makes use of the location, and you really feel the effects of the war, not just on the geography, but the psyche of the film. You have this... Also, I guess I should maybe take a step back and just say, I love the interplay between fiction and nonfiction. And I think that's explored in really interesting ways in The Third Man. The way that you have Holly Martins, the Joe Cotton character, is this American pulp fiction writer who kind of sees everything through this idiotic simplicity of like, well, you know, these guys are just smuggling cigarettes. What's the big deal? And it's like the reality is, no, they're diluting penicillin and killing children. That's the real criminal offense of the picture. Spoiler alert, I guess. But it also has a tremendous late picture performance by Orson Welles, who plays Joseph Cotton's friend that you think is dead, Harry Lime. And there's a tremendous scene in a Ferris wheel where they're looking down at the people down below from a great height. And Joe Cotton is saying, oh man, Harry, how could you do all these terrible things? And Welles' performance is so dialed in and kind of spooky. He's very logical in the way that Lime Joe Cotton's character is so kind of romantic and dumb, for lack of a better word. But in this very rational way, Welles looks down all the people and says, look at them down there. Look at all those ants. Would you really feel bad if one of them just stopped moving? And if you were making more and more money with every ant that stopped moving, free of income tax, how much would you really care? And I think that the ethical questions posed by this movie are very, very important to 1949 and to 2022.
And they will remain relevant because, yeah, that you just described what unregulated capitalism, i.e. organized crime, is. Yeah, without ethical restraints, it just makes sense to kill people for profit.
Yeah.
Fucking hell.
Fucking hell.
All right, I haven't seen it. I got to see The Third Man.
It's a blast. It's a great score done all on zither. Really tremendous Dutch angles. Oh, it's a hoot. The second film I'm going to name for this list is from 1958. It is 9 years after The Third Man, and it's Vertigo by Alfred Hitchcock. I think that this is you could spit and hit a defense of this movie. I feel like every nice thing that's been said about this movie is completely justified. It's fallen out of favor in recent years, I think, because it's not an entirely pleasurable experience watching Vertigo. And I think, again, it goes back to Hitchcock's total control over the project. It begins very, very slowly. The film is almost glacially paced at the beginning. I mean, there's so much screen time devoted to just watching Jimmy Stewart drive around San Francisco. And then the end is done almost at breakneck speed. Like, you kind of like have to really think about what just happened, because it's over almost before you know it. And that structure mirrors a spiral, which is such an important image in the context of Vertigo. I also think Jimmy Stewart is an extremely unlikable character. I mean, we're talking about, you know, Mr. Smith, who went to Washington. It's really crazy to see him play this alcoholic, unemployed ex-cop who is clearly traumatized by his experiences in the war and almost dying in the first scene of the film. And you watch as he just manipulates and abuses this woman, Judy, who you later realize is the Madeline, or the fake Madeline from the first part of the film. And there's something about this kind of, I don't know, white knuckle misogyny that I think is really hard to get through, but I feel like it's a really important document in this way. And also, it's 1959, or sorry, it's 1958. I Am the Devil takes place in 1959 in San Francisco. And there's a way in which there is like this kind of mania, and the animated dream sequence in the film could very well be described as hallucinogenic. And there's a connection there as well. The third film takes place another 9 years later, and it's John Borman's Point Blank from 1967, where Lee Marvin plays a thief who was double-crossed by his partner and his wife and goes out for revenge. The asterisk at the end of that synopsis is it's unclear if the events on screen are actually happening or if they're a hallucination he's experiencing in the throes of dying. And they maintain this ambiguity throughout the film. The picture also begins in San Francisco, so there's another point of connection there. And again, a kind of hallucinogenic treatment to some of the imagery and sound. I mean, at this point, we're in the late 60s, so there is kind of more of a vocabulary for these things, but you're still dealing with, you know, Lee Marvin, a guy who claims that he learned how to act by pretending to not be afraid during combat in the Second World War. You have the scene where he goes into the wife's house and he's knocking over the perfumes and the weird ointments that she has into the bathtub, and they shatter, and the camera just lingers on all of this technicolored muck kind of bleeding into itself. And it feels very much like those kind of oil lamps that were shown at rock shows back in the day, sort of proto performance visuals. I think also this film was important to me in the sense that it was one of the earliest instances of how important sound design was. There's a great scene. It's iconic, where he's walking out of the airport. He's walking down the corridor in LAX, and his shoes are just echoing through this chamber. It's clack, 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 clack. And then he's in the rental car. Clack, 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 clack. The shoes are just keep going. We're cutting back and forth to the wife in the hair salon. You hear those shoes reverberating, and it's this idea of just he's coming. You know, he's almost there, and then, you know, eventually he arrives. Yeah, I don't know. I think Point Blank is a really vibey movie in general.
Excellent. I like the list. I will add that it's news to me that Vertigo isn't beloved anymore because I'm out of touch. But yeah.
I think a lot of people still do love Vertigo, but like I feel like every year there is some debate as to whether or not it actually belongs on, you know, the best of list that the like, you know, Sight and Sound will put out. Or
for sure. And I like what you said about sound design, because isn't it interesting when you go back and watch some classics and you realize how much film language has changed for the better in a lot of ways, not just with technology, but people understanding just how important sound can be. Like sometimes you go back and watch old stuff, and besides some pretty rough edits, like you'll see rough edits in the 50s and 60s, but often sound was just like ignored.
One of the most informative sonic experiences I've ever had cinematically was in 2007. I was at a pretty rundown movie theater in Berkeley, California, and I was seeing No Country for Old Men. It was a pretty sparsely populated theater, and you know, the film is very quiet. There's these long stretches of silence. And I was sitting in this theater, and in these quiet stretches, I kept thinking I heard something, and it was the sound of men screaming. And I thought to myself, oh my God, the Coen brothers are geniuses. They're subliminally seeding this Cormac McCarthy story with the sound of violence and madness and chaos. And I was so pleased at this experience. And I walked out and I realized, oh man, Beowulf is playing next door. And I just heard it bleeding through the walls. But
I remember that. God, it's been so long. The theatrical experience has been so affected by pandemics the last few years. I forget that experience of being at a multiplex and hearing, yeah, if you see a quiet film next to an action film, it's kind of hilarious.
Yeah, it's wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So question, good top three. So next question is a film that is underrated.
I think this film is probably growing in estimation. I feel like it was like restored in the last couple of years, but I'm still going to say Sorcerer from 1977, the William Friedkin film. I don't know if I would say Sorcerer is the greatest American film of the 1970s, but it's certainly the last great American film of the 1970s. For the uninitiated, it's a remake of Wages of Fear, the French film by Henri Clouzot, I think was the director. And it's the Friedkin version is set in this hellish, impoverished South American jungle village where you have a defector from the Irish mob, a French embezzler, a Palestinian terrorist, and a hitman from Veracruz, I want to say. Oh, there's also a Nazi that's living there in a funny reveal. But you have these four guys that have to get out of this place. And the only way they can scrounge up the cash to do it is by driving these trucks full of nitroglycerin across a mountain range. And it's really funny because Friedkin made a name for himself with The French Connection, which has one of arguably the best chase scenes of all time. Coming from that, you know, high octane experience, it's really funny for him to do a movie about how important it is to drive slowly. It also has a great soundtrack by Tangerine Dream, the first soundtrack they ever did. He described this film and why he wanted to make it as being about four characters with no redeeming qualities whatsoever, who hated each other, but nevertheless had to work together so they wouldn't all blow up. And I feel like that's a really important metaphor for human life on this planet.
Absolutely. And I'm going to pick up on something you said, where you said it might be the last great film of the 70s. And it came out the same year as Star Wars, I guess.
Yeah.
Is it that the blockbuster, right? It was, right? Jaws in 76 and Star Wars in 77.
Well, you know,
changed Hollywood.
This was a box office. This is one of those things where it's like Icarus flew too close to the sun. I mean, back to back, Friedkin does French Connection and then The Exorcist. Everyone's like, ooh, what's he going to do next? And this is what he decides to do next. And, you know, it bombed. Star Wars was a huge hit.
As was Jaws the year before.
Friedkin was part of the director's company with Coppola and I think Bogdanovich as well. And Coppola came to Friedkin and was like, hey, well, my friend wrote this script. I think we should maybe produce it. What do you think? And it was George Lucas's Star Wars. And Friedkin said, I don't want anything to do with this sci-fi garbage. And he could have been a producer on Star Wars. But alas and alack, that was not what fate had in store for Billy F. But look, there were great films that came out in the wake of Sorcerer. Obviously, you know, Apocalypse Now, 78, 79, Girlfriends. Like there are great films, but it's not the same thing, you know. Coppola got some distribution money from United Artists, but he financed Apocalypse Now largely himself, almost bankrupted him. Girlfriends was made with grant money. You know, Sorcerer is a really bold movie that was financed entirely by the studios. That's crazy. That's wild.
I feel like sharing, it probably isn't the case now, but all through the 80s and 90s, it was a source of pride around Burbank and the Valley. Everyone who had a bounced American Zoetrope check, so signed by Francis Ford Coppola, they put them on the wall like that first dollar your business ever made. Like, yeah, Coppola bounced a check here.
Wow, that's great. I love that.
Yeah, it used to be like all the equipment houses and stuff. You'd see the Zoetrope checks, American Zoetrope.
That's so funny. Wow, I love that.
Yeah, very. Everyone survived. Everyone survived it.
Huh?
Well, excellent. Okay, now I'm looking forward to this answer. A film that is overrated.
Godfather Part Two. I got to give it to Godfather Part Two. I think, look, those movies are very well made. Technically speaking, great. Performances are wonderful. The second one, like, honestly, the Robert De Niro sequences are beautiful. Wonderful. He's never been more attractive on screen, I would say. The problem with those movies, like, the problem with so many films, is the script. You cannot tell me, you cannot convince me that Michael Corleone is a compelling character. In the first film, he's a cipher. I don't know this guy. You know, he's kind of a secondary character who comes in at the end and becomes a major character. I feel like Godfather 2 suffers from this problem of they haven't really cracked the code for how to do a sequel. So the ethos of Godfather 2 is kind of like, what if Godfather 1, but more? So it kind of hits the same beats if you were to like kind of lay them on top of each other. The structure is almost identical, except now it's, you know, Lee Strasberg as Hiram Roth as the heavy. And you know, Michael is, you know, it's just kind of like, well, how's Michael going to get out of this one? I do think, you know, the, John Cazale Fredo arc is good, but that's because John Cazale is really good. I feel like because we don't know who Michael is, it's really hard to care about that familial betrayal on a personal level. Maybe it works in the context of literature. I don't know. I don't know if Puzo's novel goes into it more.
Yeah, my understanding is both films equal the novel, right?
I don't know. But, I never read the book.
But I'm with you 100% because I've heard, and sometimes when people ask me to name my overrated, sometimes it is Godfather 2 because I have the luxury of changing my answer all the time. Because I've heard a lot of people say Godfather 2 is the best sequel ever made. It's the only one of the rare sequels that's better than the first. And I mean, I rewatched them and fairly recently, actually. Well, not recently, but in 2020 when you couldn't go out. And it was just, it's just not as good as the first.
No, it's not.
In any way. And I thought you were going to say, and for me, the De Niro scenes back in Italy, you know, might be nice, but they're irrelevant to the story.
Yeah.
I don't really need to know Marlon Brando's backstory of how he grew up. I just need to know who he is in Godfather, in The Godfather.
Well, I do think, again, it's like to say, to go into this is almost to give the film too much credit. I love the moment after De Niro shoots the guy and like the towel catches on fire. The moment where he holds his son on the stoop and says, Michael, your father loves you very much. If they had made the film about how the Marlon Brando character really did love his family, and Michael never really cracked that code, he never really knew how to love, that would be a compelling film. But that's not the film they made. So, you know, no, I feel
just,
like honestly,
it just becomes mafia porn. It's just like how cool it is that they go around killing people, right?
I mean, to that effect, I feel like you could almost make a case that young David Chase saw The Godfather 2, saw the film that could have been there, and that was one of the points of inspiration for The Sopranos, which I do feel like is a really good film about that kind of generational degradation of values. Or, sorry, a good series about the degradation of values.
Fair enough. All right. I would say more things I don't like about Godfather 2, but it's irrelevant. I'm with you, I think. And again, it's, by the way, it's a good film.
Yeah, no.
But it's just overrated because a lot of people say it's great, 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 great.
Yeah.
And it always bothers me when someone says it's better than the first, but I don't know. I think I hear that less.
I appreciate how scrappy the first one is, too. Like, the way that the kind of cobbled together way that they put together Vegas, or you know, when they're on the studio set in the background, you can see people with long hair. There's just ways where like you can kind of see the scrappiness of production in that one that I find more endearing.
And it's a tighter story.
Yeah,
it's just a tight story. Don't get me started on the Cuba scenes and Michael being a genius and knowing that the revolution's going to work. I mean, get over it. I got to get over myself on that. One last question. I know you're about to say more about Godfather 2, but it's my fault we're continuing. I had to throw in some shade. Last question is a lesser-known film people should seek out.
Again, this is a film that's very personal to me. It's The Music Lovers by Ken Russell from 1970. I saw this movie only once, but it left like an indelible stain on me, which was, I think, you know, I had seen, you know, all these, you know, period pieces, and I, in my head there was always the you know the pageantry and the gowns and the Music Lovers was the first film that I saw where I thought, oh man, you could tell a historical nonfiction story and make it feel like an absolute nightmare. That film is so scary. It's a biopic about Tchaikovsky, the composer, but it's menacing in the way that Russell puts it together. It's so scary. Richard Chamberlain plays Tchaikovsky, and a lot of it is about how Tchaikovsky was gay. And there's this terrifying scene where he and his new bride, Glenda Jackson, who's really, really fucking good in it, as his long-suffering, mentally ill wife. They're riding off on a train after their wedding and their honeymoon, and she's kind of like, really, she doesn't know anything's wrong yet, but she's like so drunk on love, and she's writhing around on the ground, and the lights are going past her, and you feel Richard Chamberlain's revulsion at this woman who just wants to love him. It's really an upsetting film, and I cannot recommend it enough.
I haven't seen it, and I'm a Ken Russell fan. I think Ken Russell, I love his films.
Oh yeah, no,
one yeah, of he's one of those masters that I think a lot of people kind of skip now.
Yeah, The Devils,
and
Altered States,
Man Who Fell to Earth, right?
No, that's no. That's Nicholas Rogue.
Oh, Rogue, right?
He's also
right.
Really good. I love those pictures.
Yeah. My bad, confusing them.
No, they're both great.
Yeah. Okay, well, excellent answers.
Hey.
I'm going to wrap us up. But first I should throw it to you for people who are interested in your answers just now and they want to see more from you or hear about your film. You want to give the web address and social media?
Yes. You can find me on the web at www.mikeheresy, that's one word, mikeheresy.com, or on Instagram at mikeheresy.
Perfect. And now I will, because I don't know, I feel like I should rush. I'll try to efficiently get us through this closing spiel, which is, you just heard Mike Harris answer the Discover Indie Film 4 questions. If you want to see his film, I Am the Devil, go to Amazon Prime Video after January 15th, 2023, and go to type in Discover Indie Film in the search field and go to season 7. I Am the Devil will be in there with some other kick-ass films. I think I know what I'm pairing you with, but I'm not going to say it yet, but two very cool films that were submitted to either the Sherman Oaks Film Festival or Film Invasion Los Angeles in the Art House Experimental category. Full disclosure, my favorite category. If I had to devote a film festival to one category, I'd say other people can show the dramas. I love comedy. I love drama. I love it all. But give me the art house stuff that doesn't have a home everywhere. Because, oh man, I love that people are still making avant-garde films. It's funny. There was a real debate whether to call the category avant-garde or art house experimental.
Huh.
And it was one of the board members was like, avant-garde might turn people off.
Yeah, I mean, I think people may think they're signing up for a Stan Brakhage film if it's avant-garde.
And if someone made a film that is highly experimental but also really funny, like they'll be like, well, I'm not avant-garde.
Yeah.
But like experimental sort of covers more ground. So anyway, go to Amazon Prime Video. Watch I Am the Devil in Discover Indie Film Season 7. If you want to learn more about this podcast or that TV series that was born out of it, go to discoverindiefilm.com. On social media, it's always at DIFWINS. And I just mentioned the two film festivals. I Am the Devil was an official selection at the Sherman Oaks Film Festival in November 2020. You can learn about that festival if you go to ShermanOaksFF.com, and it's at ShermanOaksFF on social media. Film Invasion Los Angeles, which is the sister festival we hold every June. People ask, what's the difference between the two? There is none. Same team, same everything, same board members. We just couldn't pick a name. And we figured we would do both the first year, and then whichever did better, we'd stick with. And instead, I just moved them 6 months apart. And because Sherman Oaks gets a lot of local support, Film Invasion Los Angeles gets more stuff from overseas. So there you go. People like the name LA. So go to filminvasionla.com or at filminvasionla on social media. And I won't ramble on, but if you like THC and you're listening to this, go to thccinema.com or at thccinema on social media and see some fun, some tips on some fun shit that I do just as a release valve.
Just Blaze.
Just Blaze. that would be a good motto for it. All right. Mike Harris, thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Jeff.
It's been an absolute pleasure. And thank you, everyone, for listening.